Blog Talk Radio. And welcome to another exciting Eastern Radio Talk Show episode. In fact, episode 33. We're coming to you live tonight from Lake City, Florida, Martha's Vineyard, Massachusetts, Roaring Gap, North Carolina, and Jacksonville, Florida. Our hosts for the show tonight are Steve McDonald in Live Oak, Jim Hart in Martha's Vineyard, Steve Thompson in Roaring Gap, North Carolina, and Neil Holland, Bud Hiscock, and me, Margaret Bars in Jacksonville, Florida. Our producer is Eric Otero, also here in Jacksonville. Tonight's call-in numbers are area code 213-816-1611. And the toll-free number is 877-572-1861. So let me repeat those numbers for you once again. Area code 213-816-1611, and our toll-free number, 877-572-1861. Now, please do call in with your questions or just add your thoughts about our show tonight. And speaking of tonight's show, it has a parallel to those written by famed aviation novelist Captain Ernest Gann, who, by the way, was made an honorary life member of the retired Eastern Pilots Association, known as REPA, many years before his passing. His book, Fate is the Hunter, was a bestseller when it was first published and was later made into a movie. Another of Ernie Gann's books, called The High and the Mighty, was made into a movie starring an Academy Award winner, the infamous John Wayne. Now, my favorite quote of the book was in reference to flying through thunderstorms, and it goes something like this: "A pilot may earn his full pay for that year in less than 2 minutes. At the time of the incident, he would gladly return the entire amount for the privilege of being elsewhere." And having said that, let's listen to the movie trailer for Fate is the Hunter.
All right, engine just blew. Fire warning light and bell.
Take off. Suspense builds at supersonic speed as you learn the inside story of an airline pilot in this jet age and the men and women who hold your fate in their hands. Glenn Ford, who fought to prove his friend a hero when his critics called him a heel.
Come on, let's go! I told you to get out of here! Bundy! Bundy, come on!
I'm in command of this plane and that's an order now, off!
The beautiful Chinese girl. How did she change the pilot's life and her own? Suzanne Pleshette. How much did love play in her decision? Wally Cox, who owed him more than he could tell.
Look, I'll be right behind you. Let's get the hell out of here.
And Jane Russell, who started a private war of her own. Tension mounts with every stunning moment as you come face to face with an experience you'll remember as long as you live.
All right, let's get him back in. Other engine.
Radar control.
Chop it, chop it off. He's gone. He's dropped too low for the radar.
The big, sleek Boeing 767 was knifing its way across the cold, crystal-clear Canadian sky. At the time, it was the newest and most sophisticated commercial aircraft in service. It could fly higher and more efficiently than any of the older generation of jetliners. The long white contrails following it gave evidence of the power being generated by its two big Pratt & Whitney fan jet engines. Suddenly, without warning, one of the contrails disappeared, then the other. Both engines had quit. Incredibly, the aircraft was out of fuel, and it began its long, fearful glide back to the ground.
Technology in aviation has moved ahead at such a rapid pace. Everyone involved has been hard-pressed to keep up. Today, computers perform calculations and store information that was formerly done manually by pilots. Radio operators used to type a log of the conversation that took place with the aircraft in flight. Flight crews logged and transmitted their times over each geographic checkpoint, along with ground speed of the aircraft, figured on a little circular slide rule invented by United pilot L. Ray Jepson. We called it the Jepson computer. Air traffic control centers provided separation amongst aircraft, using the times and altitude reported by the aircraft over specific ground stations. Then they checked the flight crew's estimates with their own Jepson computers. Fuel consumption was also figured on these little pocket slide rules. Onboard fuel was first measured on the ground by sticking the tanks with a fuel measuring stick. This was to confirm the reading on the fuel gauges in the cockpit. Seat-of-the-pants calculations were also figured in. Harold Huff once said, "When taking off from Atlanta, you knew you were flying a heavy DC-4 when you looked up instead of down at the College Park water tank near the end of the runway as you passed it by." Even more primitive was our means of early navigation. Just after World War II, we were still finding our way along lighted airways markers. It was a series of rotating light beacons on the ground, spaced along an airway. Each flashed an identifying signal with a white light, while a beacon at an airport was green. The old Adcock radio range was a ground signal received in our headsets that gave us an audio beam to fly when you couldn't see the beacons on the ground because of bad weather. The volume knobs of our aircraft radios were worn smooth from constant adjustment of the changing volume. Close attention was given to the bracketing this Adcock radio beam until the aircraft was over the station, indicated by a sudden silence called the cone of silence. The specific light bulb called a marker beacon on our instrument panel would illuminate as an additional confirmation of being over the proper station.
With the advent of both the Boeing 757 flown by Eastern and the later Boeing 767, a whole new technology was introduced. One strong factor about the airplane is the pilots were involved in the design of the aircraft and a lot of thought went into its development. Among its other many attributes was its incredible performance. It had so much power, it would take off with a full load from small airports such as Midway and Chicago, and it would stop very quickly when it was touched down. When a compromise was finally reached with the Airline Pilots Association over the use of a two-man crew in the cockpit, certain capabilities were required, among which was the aircraft was to have a flight management system to monitor flight progress. Navigation functions could be programmed into the flight management computer, which is even more accurate than the Omega system that used radio fixes from ultra-low frequency stations around the globe. The flight management computer aligns itself with true north and the Earth's rotation so the pilot knows where he or she is at all times. The flight path is programmed into the inertial reference unit, which is a navigational device that utilizes laser gyros rather than the gimbal gyros employed in the inertial navigation system. It's the system that's used to navigate our spacecraft, by the way. And it's a piece of equipment with incredible accuracy. So much so that a small error has been built in to preserve the secrecy. Another innovation is the ability of the Boeing 757 and 767 to automatically change power. At the altitude where the changeover from indicated airspeed to Mach occurs, the aircraft computers handle the change in engine power. The aircraft will level off at cruise altitude and sets the power automatically. The auto throttles operate from takeoff. Can operate from takeoff through landing. Another innovation is the instrumentation by which the electronic flight instrument system, which presents the pilot with the image on a tube comprising the instrument panel. It's powered electrically, but has a standby gyro operated by the ship's battery. The pilot may select what he or she wants to see. All of the essential flight instruments are consolidated into a single attitude director indicator. A glide slope flight director, instrument landing system, radio altimeter, and a fast slow indicator. For redundancy, three inertial reference units, three instrument landing systems, and three autopilots are provided. In a case of a generator failure or engine failure, or normal engine starting or galley electrical overload, there is an automatic shedding of the electrical load. Electrically operated equipment is turned off automatically, and the auxiliary power unit picks up the load when it's turned on. The same concept of automation is used for the pneumatic and the air conditioning systems, allowing the pilots to concentrate their attention on flying the airplane. Although not high volume, it has electric hydraulic pumps that are available as backup for engine-driven hydraulic pumps. An alternate landing gear extension pump operates off direct current supplied by the battery. It opens the landing gear door so that the gear will free fall. And the landing flaps are lowered by an alternate means using electric pump with power supplied by the auxiliary power unit.
Eastern captain and instructor Virgil Tedder notes that there is a flip side to all this advanced technology. It's called reversion, and is recognized by NASA as presenting a problem. When a pilot transfers from the Boeing 757, in which many of the functions are automatic, back to the Boeing 727, it is sometimes difficult to adjust to the many basic habits of the earlier aircraft in which these functions were accomplished manually. There comes a time when it is prudent for the pilot to disconnect all the automatic functions and fly manually. A case in point would be if you were suddenly notified by air traffic control that you were on a collision course with another aircraft and to descend immediately. The automatic functions of the flight management system would initiate the descent smoothly with passenger comfort as the primary consideration, whereas an immediate response is required. Reversion may have played a role in the flight of the 767 over Canada, as they now found themselves in a power-off glide headed for somewhere on the ground. In his book, Fate is a Hunter, Ernest Gann regards life as a war, an undeclared war against the fate that hunts men down. There are many expressions which depict the fateful situations in which the aviator sometimes finds himself. When there is no foreseeable way out, it could be said that one would have his back to the wall, be deep in the well, be between a rock and a hard place, or up the creek without a paddle, or up against it. To the aviator, he would be left with nothing but the compass and the clock.
Now, how many of us have been down to the compass and the clock? Certainly Captain Olin King and his co-pilot R.A. Kelly found themselves in that situation in 1945 as they attempted a landing in bad weather in Florence, South Carolina, following some undisclosed emergency aloft. Fate dealt them a losing hand. Jimmy Goodwin recalls that the DC-3 crashed in a dense swamp about 8 miles northwest of Florence. The fact that all bodies in the passenger compartment were crowded into the front, along with other evidence, indicated that a fire in the cabin may have caused the emergency.
Fate was far more benevolent with Pitcairn pilot Johnny Keitel, a 1924 Brooks Field Army classmate of Charles Lindbergh. Keitel was descending on instruments in a Pitcairn mail wing bound for Atlanta, and unknowingly he touched down on the top of Stone Mountain near Atlanta, and the plane came to a complete stop. Johnny climbed out of the plane, collected his mail sacks, and walked down the mountain and hitchhiked a ride to the Atlanta airport to deliver the mail. Johnny Keitel loved stunt flying and frequently put on a show just before landing with the mail. Fate claimed his life in 1931 as he was demonstrating a snap roll in a GB aircraft. The wing came off and the snap roll continued all the way until he hit the ground.
Fate was also unkind to Captain Bill Cooney and his co-pilot Kenneth Willingham as they were flying the DC-4 from New York to Miami in 1947. Jimmy Goodwin also remembers the details of their ill-fated flight. Near Port Deposit, Maryland, a DC-3 with three members of the Civil Aeronautics Administration accident investigating team were overtaken by a faster DC-4. The weather was clear and unlimited visibility, and shortly after the DC-4 had passed, those in the CAA DC-3 observed the DC-4 go from level flight into a vertical dive. In the ensuing crash, 53 people lost their lives. It was the worst accident in U.S. aviation history at the time. And some people thought that the gust lock may have been actuated in flight, perhaps either as a result of a prank, locking the controls, causing the aircraft to enter a climb. Now, this would have prompted the pilot flying to roll the elevator trim tab forward, causing the aircraft to nose over into a dive when the gust lock was disengaged. Even had this occurred, it would seem the two pilots could have made a recovery. A more plausible explanation is contained in Ernest Gann's book, Fate is the Hunter, as he describes his experience in the DC-4 involving a phenomenon known as importing. Importing is the balanced destruction of the elevators by aerodynamic force. If enough separation between the fixed and the balanced portion of the elevator occurs, the aircraft will enter into a vertical dive or even go beyond vertical, and no two pilots would be strong enough to overcome the force. Gann had been on a DC-4 flight in which he experienced a strange vibration, which he and his crew were unable to explain. Now, they did not reduce the speed because of a previous experience of an engine failure on all four engines when they throttled back. So they continued on to the destination with the power remaining at cruise. So for the next leg of the flight, they took on an amount of fuel that brought their gross takeoff weight up to the same weight as the previous flight, in which they had more passengers and flew at the same speed. A combination of weight and speed prevented the phenomena of unboarding from taking place. For had Gann not maintained the speed and taken the extra fuel, the aircraft would likely have entered into a vertical dive. The vibration had been caused by a whole elevator being loose. One of the hinge bolts securing the elevator was missing. And fate had dealt Gann a kinder hand than it did Bill Cooney and Kenneth Willingham.
Fate was considerate in 1934 when Captain Al Laney and co-pilot Francis Black encountered a fire in their DC-2. Thought to be in the rear baggage compartment, wisely Al Laney selected a cotton patch and landed immediately with no casualties. Francis Black got off a hurried emergency message saying, "We are landing. Our tail is burning off." The radio operator on ground thought he had heard him say, "We are landing to take the mail off." In 1946, the de-icing equipment of a DC-3 was totally inadequate to handle the icing condition that occurred along the Gulf Coast that winter, and especially between Beaumont and Houston.
Fate was charitable to Captain Shelley Charles and your Bill Malone, as Shelley gave the finest performance of his flying career. He was called upon to reach for all of his previous experience in both airplanes and sailplanes to sustain flight with the incredible load of ice that accumulated all over the ship. Climbing in search of the warmer air in the temperature inversion only produced additional ice to an already floundering ship. Added to the dilemma were the freezing controls. Shelley was able to free them by continually moving the rudders, elevators, and ailerons. The landing in Houston was a masterpiece of flying skill as our ice-laden DC-3 wallowed up to the end of the runway. All was not without a price. When they arrived back in Atlanta, Shelley checked into the hospital with a hernia. It was as though he had carried the airplane to Houston and back all by himself.
You could say that fate was charitable in the case of Archie Comer, who was flying a modern Lockheed Electra over Tennessee in bad weather when the stewardess came forward to tell him that the floor back in the passenger cabin was caving in and felt pretty hot to the touch. The electrical buses began to transfer automatically back and forth, as indicated on the overhead electrical panel in the cockpit. Then suddenly, all electrical power was lost. This presented a dilemma of enormous proportions, as most everything on the Electra is operated by electricity. There was no doubt in the fact that Archie Comer was left with nothing but the compass and the clock. Those of us who are familiar with the event have no doubt in our minds but that he gave one of the finest demonstrations of flying skill known at the time, as he completed an approach and safe landing at Nashville. It was later discovered that a strap had come loose from a main electrical bus and fallen across another main bus, creating an arc that shorted out the entire electrical system. Bud, what do you got?
Well, George Bost won his war against the fate when he took off from LaGuardia Field in his Martin 404. Unknown to him and the pilots of the DC-4 that had just taken off ahead of him, a severe icing condition had settled over the area. All four engines of the DC-4 suddenly iced up, and the airplane crashed on Rikers Island just north of the airport. George Bost was already airborne before the pilots in the DC-4 were able to report the encounter. The Martin 404 required the use of a device connected to the BMEP, which means brake mean effective power gauge, which would cause the engine falling below a preset power output setting to auto feather. One of George's engines auto feathered, and the power on the other dropped to 25%. Later, when describing his ordeal, George Bost said that by the time he was so deep in the well, he had his hand on the landing flap handle and was preparing to land in Flushing Bay. At the low power output, the carburetor heat was not available. At a last resort, he called upon his ingenuity and used an old airmail pilot trick. He turned the ignition off and then back on for the engine that was still running, causing it to backfire and blow the ice out of the carburetor. Then the carburetor heat could be applied. The co-pilot reported that the other engine had auto-feathered. George said, "Well, see if we can unfeather it." George told us later that it unfeathered at takeoff power, but it sure sounded good. But then he did not know whether they would fly under the Whitestone Bridge or over it. He and his co-pilot succeeded in climbing out of the icing conditions, but it was an experience that they would never forget.
Fate pointed its fickle finger at Chuck White, who managed to land his Lockheed Constellation safely on the side of a hill in North Salem, Connecticut, after encountering a mid-air collision. 50 of his passengers survived, but when Chuck went back to the smoldering fuselage to try to free a soldier who was trapped, gasoline that had been leaking from the wreckage exploded, killing both Chuck White and the soldier he was trying to rescue.
Well, I remember an incident where fate dealt a low blow to Curtis Fitz and Martin Calloway as they took off from Boston in their Lockheed Electra. They encountered a huge flock of birds that were ingested into the engines. And it was thought that the propellers of two engines on the same side went into flat pitch, and then the engines on the other side surged, causing them to lose control and crash into the bay. Now, miraculously, two stewardesses in the rear of the passenger cabin, along with many of the passengers, escaped. Curtis Fitz and Martin Calloway were not so lucky.
Steve, I was, this is Jim Hart again, I was in Hartford, Springfield at the time, and our district manager, Fred Blackwell, and I went over to Boston to try to help in that situation. There wasn't much we could do except to console the people who were seeing their young men off.
Well, fate continued her game as Steve Parkinson came out of a thunderstorm between Washington and Baltimore in a DC-8 inverted, yes, upside down. When asked how he knew they were upside down, he replied, "Through the eyebrow windows, we could see cars driving down the freeway." Together, he and his co-pilot were able to right the airplane.
Mel French was well aware of the danger of picking up too much speed in the DC-8. He'd often said that the airplane was so clean and streamlined that that could pose a problem. While he was absent from the cockpit, using the restroom, the airplane encountered turbulence. The DC-8 entered a vertical dive. Mel French climbed back into the cockpit hand over hand and reversed all four engines. Two of the engines were carried away, but the aircraft slowed to a point where they were able to pull out of the dive. Their encounter and a later incident over Lake Pontchartrain caused a whole new technique of flying in turbulence to be adopted industry-wide. Mel checked into the hospital so he could not be questioned until he was prepared to the FAA questions after his incident.
You could say that fate smiled on Tom Mayberry the day he was hijacked to Cuba in his DC-9. Tom was so low on fuel, he literally landed on the fumes in the tanks. From then on, Tom said, "Fill her up. The only time you have too much fuel is when you are on fire." Lee Hines was less fortunate when the hijackers of his airplane shot and killed the Eastern Airlines agent in Houston, and Lee had to continue the flight under such duress.
The pilots of the Boeing 767 over Canada, who were completely out of fuel, were in their prolonged glide from 41,000 feet. In the book Free Fall by William Hoffer and Marilyn Mona Hoffer, they describe in vivid detail what happened. The 767 utilized a computer known as a fuel quantity processor, which relayed information to the fuel gauges in the cockpit. There had been a previous failure of the fuel quantity processor. The gauge for the right tank was blank, but the reading on the left gauge was 6 point something. What the crew thought to be the left tank fuel gauge was merely indicating as a thermometer measuring the temperature of the fuel in the tanks and reporting it on the Celsius scale. However, on separate video monitors, the flight management computer had taken over for the blank fuel gauge, giving a concise summary of the fuel load. For the want of a nail, the shoe is lost. For the want of a shoe, the horse is lost. For the want of a horse, the rider is lost. Unbeknown to the pilots, there existed an improper connection in the microprocessor, a cold-soldered joint causing a partial, improper connection that was the first link in this bizarre set of events. Had the joint been severed, then no current would have passed across the channel in the fuel quantity processor, and the channel would have been deactivated. Then the fuel quantity processor would have operated efficiently on the other channel. In this case, the partial connection allowed a partial voltage to flow through, and this was just enough to default the system. Fueling was performed using the drift sticks, which was measuring the level of fuel in the tanks. The flight was dispatched, requiring 22,300 kilograms of fuel. This particular aircraft specifications consisted of a mix of metric and imperial numbers. Fuel quantity was calculated in kilograms. Thrust was designated in pounds. Even the mechanics had to have two sets of tools, one metric and one imperial, to service the aircraft. The Canadian government had brought pressure to bear to go to the metric system of measurement. In Toronto, a butcher was prosecuted for selling his meat by the pound instead of by the kilogram. Instead of refueling on the fuel gauges in the airplane, which were inoperative, the fueler had to use the gauges on his truck, which measurements were in liters, not in kilograms. The fueler had to pump a specific volume of fuel to reach the desired weight. There was fuel remaining in the tanks from the previous flight. Weight of kerosene varies with temperature. The whole process became a Chinese fire drill. With a switch from three cockpit crew members to two, fuel calculations became the responsibility of maintenance, but maintenance had not been trained in these calculations. The wrong conversion factor was used, and the aircraft departed with insufficient fuel.
Well, this 767 aircraft is now out of 41,000 feet in its power-off glide. And passengers had been briefed for an emergency landing as it descended through 22,000 feet. Air traffic control transmitted that they had lost contact with the ship's transponder. A mayday call was made by the flight crew in response, describing the nature of the emergency and further stating the flight was being made on emergency instruments. The flight crew was now down to the compass and the clock. Now, the air traffic controller was also in the same situation because he was having to utilize the old primary radar to track the flight of an ill-fated airplane. So a decision was made to attempt a dead-stick landing at an abandoned Royal Canadian Air Force field. Using a makeshift cardboard ruler, now the controller kept the flight crew apprised of their distance from the abandoned runway. And the absence of fuel offset the drag of the windmilling engine, so the descent profile used by all pilots in the jet to determine remained virtually the same. All attention was directed to conforming to this profile. An emergency call was made from the air traffic control to the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, as was a request for all available police and firefighting equipment. Then, with a final sweep on the radar screen, the aircraft descended below the reception level, and the blip disappeared.
Unknown to both the pilots and the controllers, the Winnipeg Sports Car Club was having a rally at the RCAF field, and their final straightaway was right down the runway the crew of the Boeing 767 had planned on using for their landing. Many spectators were present. All sorts of activities were taking place, including a vehicular scavenger hunt. A festive atmosphere prevailed. Tents were pitched, campers were parked alongside the runway, barbecues were cooking on grills, even a Cessna 152 was overhead. On the final segment of their approach, the aircraft appeared to the flight crew to be high, so the landing gear was lowered using the alternate landing gear extension pump operating off direct current supplied by the battery. The landing gear doors opened and the main gear dropped out, but the nose gear remained up and it remained in the up position. Landing flaps and slats were unavailable as the auxiliary power unit could not be started. They didn't have any fuel. The pilot initiated a side slip to lose altitude.
One can imagine what the reaction would be of those observing from the ground. A huge jet airliner approaching at a weird angle with no sound. As the aircraft touched down and the nose slid along the runway, in a shower of sparks, everyone rushed to get out of the way. The aircraft plowed through the post of a low metal guardrail, erected along the center of the runway and slid to a stop. In the moments of great stress, bizarre events often occur. As the passengers began their emergency evacuation, the co-pilot reached up and deactivated the fuel control switches to prevent any fire. There was no fuel left in the tanks to burn. The captain set the parking brake, which was also unnecessary because they had already stopped. Both pilots reached up and pulled the fire control switches. Then they switched off the battery. Thus, the end came to an experience that began only minutes before at an altitude of 41,000 feet. Can you imagine that? And this was a situation in which the pilots found themselves down to the compass and clock.
Now, who was to blame? A special independent board of inquiry, after hearing testimony from over 120 witnesses, concluded that neither the pilots nor the mechanics were at fault. They cited a number of deficiencies in airline procedures. The chairman of the board of inquiry added, the consequence which would have been disastrous had it not been for the flying ability of the captain with valuable assistance from the first officer.
Eastern had its own near-disastrous event in May of 1983 when an L-1011 Whisperliner offshore from Miami to Nassau had three engines gradually shut down due to a loss of oil. Captain Steve Thompson, who's with us tonight, recently recalled this near-air disaster on our radio show's episode 31. Just when all seemed an inevitable setup for a crash somewhere, they were able to restart number two engine just before the decision to prepare for a crash landing or at a sea ditching. The number two engine failed just after they touched down in Miami.
We of Eastern Airlines have not been without our own problems with fuel. Ralph Pitts departed San Juan from Miami in the Lockheed 1011 with minimum fuel. And this was a standard procedure in good weather as fuel is very expensive in Puerto Rico. The fact that air traffic control issued instructions to reverse course in his climb made the minimum fuel load come close. While en route, one of the fuel gauges dropped to zero. This caused Ralph and his crew to wonder, well, has the gauge failed or has the tank not been properly fueled? So they made an unscheduled landing in Nassau. An inspection revealed that indeed the tank had not been fueled. Upon hearing of Ralph's experience, many captains never departed in the 1011 without confirming the reading on the fuel gauges by having the sticks pulled, just like in the early days of flying.
All of us at one time or another have been down to the compass and the clock. Whether it involved financial problems, illness, death of a loved one, or a close call in an airplane. Being an aviator was a great help because the very nature of our profession demanded that we face our problems with courage, tenacity, and an uncompromising strength of purpose. Flying as co-pilots with our pioneers, we learned the meaning of keeping a cool head and hanging tough. Failure was not in their vocabulary, no matter how harsh the circumstances. Ernest Gann recognized these qualities in the Eastern Airline pilot, and he spoke highly of us in his book, Fate is a Hunter. These are some of the reasons why Eastern so influenced our lives. These are some of the reasons we are so proud to be members of the Eastern Airlines family.
The Compass and the Clock was written by the late Captain Bill Malone and published in the Retired Eastern Pilot Association's magazine, Repartee, which a CD of all 35 years is available at the web store on the website www.ealradioshow.com. This would make a great Christmas or birthday gift for someone special. A limited number are still available. Now, we hope you enjoy listening to our historical skits as much as we do and putting them together and presenting them. And as you know, we are a not-for-profit organization needing the help from listeners who want to continue hearing the great stories and the memories shared over this broadcast media. We ask that you consider making a donation on our website, www.ealradioshow.com.
Yes, Margaret, we do have expenses that come due, such as renewal fees for the website and the radio show. Our producer has been giving his valuable time away from his computer consulting business and taking no pay from the radio show. He needs to receive some compensation for his travel time, so we do need our listeners to please consider a donation as to what you can afford. With nearly 600 Radio Club members now, we should be able to pay our producer for the 2 hours a week he has received in the past for his valuable service, but he's had to be cut because of limited funds available.
And we've made it very easy for you to make an online donation. Just go to the homepage, again, at www.ealradioshow.com. And in the middle of the page, you'll see a donation button. Simply click your cursor on this icon. It'll take you to any amount you wish to donate. Our appreciation will be returned with more great shows. And you'll also receive a CD of Eastern's Images of Flight. For a contribution of $50 or more, you'll receive the CD, 35 Years of Repartee, and the book on CD, The Best of Repartee. This is where the compass and the clock presented tonight was taken from. You find many stories just like these on the very great CD put together from all of the past Repartee magazines from 1978 until 2007 by Captain Jerry Frost, with the support of the Retired Eastern Pilots Association, better known as REPA.
Folks, we really do need your support for what has been a well-received radio show and website. Let's make sure it will continue. And the only way we can do that is to be able to pay the expenses associated with getting it out to you each week and on the website almost daily. This may sound like a plea from National Public Radio and TV, but it's a different cause. It's for the family and friends of the greatest airline to ever offer service to the traveling public, and still may take us to the skies again as the wings of man. So please, won't you help us just a bit by helping Eastern Airlines Information Memories, History Entertainment, and especially keeping old and past friendships alive.
Jim, now let's open our lines now for callers to give us their thoughts. Call us at 213-816-1611, or you can call us toll-free 1-877-572-1861. Now I'm going to repeat these. You can call us at 1-213-816-1611, or you can call us on our toll-free line 1-877-572-1861. Now let's see, do we have any callers?
I think while we're waiting for a caller to come on the line, let's just talk a little bit about the show that was presented tonight, The Compass and the Clock, a great short story that was written by Bill Malone. And I had the pleasure of being the editor of the Repartee magazine for several years. Captain J.B. Holder now is the editor of that great magazine. And the stories that come out of Repartee since 1978 have been stories that I think Ernie Gann could have chosen for one of his novels. As a matter of fact, let's talk a little bit about Ernie Gann. You know, I think mentioned earlier in our skit, or in our show tonight, Ernie Gann was elected as an honorary life member of the Retired Eastern Pilots Association. I don't know exactly what year that he was given that distinct membership, but he was very much a friend of Eastern Airlines. I believe he even spoke at one of the conventions. And speaking of the conventions, we do have one coming up in October, the end of October. But Ernie Gann wrote several great, great books. And if you're a fan of aviation, you might recognize some of the titles. And some of these titles were, of course, High and the Mighty. And that song itself, I believe, was the Academy Award-winning song that year, The High and the Mighty. The book that we talked about tonight, Fate is a Hunter. And in that book, as we mentioned, Ernie Gann did mention the Eastern Pilots. That, too, was made into a book, Island in the Sky. I don't know if any of you guys saw Island in the Sky. Did you see that with John Wayne? Did you see that, Steve or Jim?
I don't remember it.
Wonderful movie. So look it up. John Wayne starred in that movie.
Ernie Gann was made an honorary member in 1978 when Jerry Wood was the president of REPA.
Oh, okay. Very good. A Band of Brothers, another one of Ernie Gann's books that I think was also turned into a movie. And The Aviator. Do you remember that movie, The Aviator?
I do.
And The Blaze at Noon was another movie that in that movie was a Pitcairn mail wing, an Eastern Airlines Pitcairn mail wing. And I myself owe Ernie Gann a great deal. Because
Neil, didn't Spielberg produce The Band of Brothers?
I'm not certain. He may have done that. I'm not certain, Jim.
Yep.
But I was just mentioning the fact that I owed Ernie Gann my career with Eastern Airlines. I guess if I could consider the fact that I saw The High and the Mighty in 1955 or 58 when it was first a movie. And John Wayne inspired me that I wanted to be an airline pilot.
John.
So indirectly, Ernie Gann was responsible for me getting a job with Eastern Airlines.
Neil, what was the greatest scene in that movie, The High and the Mighty?
Yeah.
That I believe is when John Wayne slapped Robert Stack.
John Wayne was the co-pilot on the flight, and Robert Stack was the captain. And Robert Stack had decided to ditch the DC-4 in the Pacific Ocean, and John Wayne got out of his seat and went over and beat up on Robert Stack, slapped him around, and says, "We're not going to ditch this airplane." I thought, right, that really happened.
We've got someone on the line here. Area code, I believe it's the 905. I can't read it.
It's 925.
925. Area code 925.
Caller from 925, would you like to make a comment here? We've opened the mic up for you.
Well, I would like to make a comment here because I'm a first-time listener and a first-time caller, but I want to tell you that I think your radio program is first-rate, and I never was an employee of Eastern Airlines, but I was a frequent flyer on Eastern Airlines, and I think you guys are doing a great job, and I want to wish you well into the future.
How did you hear about us?
Well, I have a personal friend who has some relationship there to your program, and I heard about it through that.
We're talking to one of my really, really great friends, Dr. Thomas Fryer. Dr. Fryer and I went to college a long, long time ago. He successfully completed his mission and became, I think you have about two or three doctorate degrees, Tom, but I recognize that voice. And Tom was here in Jacksonville, Florida, and was the chairman of the Board of Trustees for the Jacksonville College here. Now it's called, I think, Florida State College. And Tom was the chairman of the trustees for that college. Now, go ahead, Tom.
Well, I was just going to say you have the history pretty well correct, but I'm awfully glad I got in on your program here today, and I take it it's every Monday afternoon at 7 o'clock your time, 4 o'clock our time. Is that right?
Let's see, 3 hours difference. Let's see, you got a calculator?
As a certified financial planner, I'll tell you that it's 3 hours.
It's 3 hours.
Very good.
And we're very pleased that you are not a member of the Wheel Club.
Tom doesn't remember that. The Wheel. Let's don't even tell him what Wheel means.
There's a lot of Eastern people that are listening to this program that know what the Wheel Club was.
Yes. Well, maybe you could tell me what it is so I'll know too.
I'll let Neil tell you in private.
Well, no, all I'll tell you on the air, because we're not operating as an airline right now, but it was those folks that a long time ago we had the idea that we were going to depart all of our flights on time. By golly, if we left the businessman standing at the gate, we would leave the businessman standing at the gate. And so we got a group of businessmen that formed their own little club, and they called it We Hate Eastern Airlines, the Wheel Club.
The Wheel Club. The Wheel Club was spelled W-H-E-A-L. We
I got you.
And it was, they actually passed around membership cards. I mean, it was a big deal. And then it really worked out for the benefit of Eastern Airlines. I think Rickenbacker really turned it into a positive advertising scheme for him.
That's good.
Very good. Well, Tom and
no,
I go
I
back.
Know what that was.
Well, Tom and I go back many years to about 1955, somewhere around there, and we won't tell you the rest of the story, will we, Tom?
That's right. Let's, for goodness sake, let's don't do that.
But thanks so much for calling in tonight. We appreciate
nice
your time.
Nice to talk to you, and I'm enjoying your show.
Thank you, and come back every Monday now.
All right. Y'all take care.
Hello to Peggy for me.
All right. Same to you.
Neil, do we have anyone in area code 561? Janet is a member of my chapter in West Palm Beach. She said she would be on tonight. Jan, are you on?
No, she's not with us yet,
okay.
Jim, but as soon as she appears, if she appears on our board tonight, we will certainly...
Is she up there in Massachusetts with you, Jim?
No, she's still down in Boca area.
Okay.
But, you know, some of the other things that we could have talked about in the program we had tonight about the compass and the clock, there were so many stories. Bob Wilbur's story in the DC-9 comes to mind.
Yeah.
And I think that's a fascinating story in the hijacking attempt there, and of course the loss of life of James Hartley. And Bob just brought the airplane in with shots through both arms, a bullet through both arms.
Oh, that was one at Logan Airport.
Yeah, Logan Airport. So fate is a hunter, yeah.
I worked that night. I saw that airplane go
by.
Oh,
my golly. My golly.
And it was something else.
Neil, this is Steve Thompson. So many incidents of this tonight's program bring back memories of incidents in our flying careers. And there is one there that is that jumps right out at me. It is a DC-3 being so overloaded with ice. I worked for Piedmont Airlines for 2 years before I came with Eastern, and my wife, Glenda, worked for Delta Airlines, and we were dating then. She was working in Charlotte as the Delta agent, and we were coming from Pinehurst to Charlotte on DC-3. We iced up so bad that we had to use takeoff power coming down the glide slope in Charlotte. And we didn't dare put the gear down, but until we waited until the last minute, till we broke out about 400 feet, put the gear down, and we got a green light just at touchdown as the airplane was just shuddering, stalling.
Yeah.
And my wife, Glenda, who I was dating then, who, by the way, happens to be listening to us now, and Glenda, say hello to everybody.
Hello, everybody.
Hello, lovely Glenda.
Hi from Martha's Vineyard.
I am enjoying this.
Hi from Martha's Vineyard, Glenda.
All right.
So that was a scary time. And an incident that was obviously reminded of in our presentation tonight. I remember one that I had
departing Washington Dulles for San Diego. Well, the briefing was that the weather was going to be great at our destination, so we took the fuel. We didn't carry any extra. When we got there, sea fog had rolled in, and we were at a landing to the south. And we went in and tried to make an instrument approach and just get down to minimums, nothing in sight. As we started our go around, the runway appeared. But we went around a couple times, made numerous attempts to get in there. We had run our fuel down to less than 4,000 pounds of tank. Mm. And it got pretty hairy there where we were trying to get a clearance to, what's that big airport out there, Riverside? There's mm-hmm. a larger
Ontario?
Airport. Ontario, thank you.
Yeah.
And finally got there, and we touched down on fumes. And
yeah.
You talk about being between the wall and the clock. I tell you, I had to wait a while just to get the underwear out of the seat.
Yeah, I think we've all had some really close calls. And real quickly, I think I have related this over the radio. One of my last trips with Eastern Airlines was from Costa Rica, San Jose, to Miami. And the co-pilot, I was flying. The co-pilot was doing the communications. The Everglades had been burning for several days, and haze was all through the Miami area. It was about noontime or 1 o'clock in the afternoon, early afternoon. You couldn't hardly see anything. It was almost down to IFR because of the smoke. And they switched us over. This was in the Boeing 757. We had about 190 people on the airplane, full load out of San Jose. Approach switched us over to Miami. We were downtown Miami at the time, right? Just coming up over downtown Miami. And the co-pilot tried to call the tower, and no answer back from the Miami tower. And we tried several times, and so I told the co-pilot, I said, why don't you go back to the approach control that switched us over and get us a new frequency? And just as we went over to Miami approach said, Eastern, make an immediate left turn. Air Canada, make an immediate left turn. And just as we started the turn, all I could see out of the co-pilot's main window was a maple leaf.
Wow.
On the tail of Air Canada. That was as close as I've ever been to an airplane in the air, and that was over downtown Miami.
Whoa.
Now, just seconds separated us from a total, I wouldn't be here today.
Absolutely.
So, you know, it comes down to the compass and the clock, which was the theme of our story today, or fate is a hunter. And we've all had these experiences, whether it's in an airplane or whether it's driving down the interstate highway, and something that is so close. And I always think that it's so much safer flying in airplanes today than hurtling down in a confined automobile down the street. And you don't know what the person coming opposite you at 60 miles an hour is going to do. You never know.
At least with a pilot, you know their trains.
Yeah. We have a caller.
704 area code.
704. We're going to open the mic. 704, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Is it?
This is Bob Itell in
North Carolina. Bob Itell.
Yeah, how
Bob,
about that?
Hello.
Steve Thompson. Bob, I'm sorry I had to. Wow.
That's okay, Steve. I realize it's getting down to the end of this whole thing, so I'll tell my story if you're willing to listen.
Well, go ahead. You've got plenty of time, Bob. Take your time.
Okay. This goes back to the time when Ben Aiken and I were ALPA reps. Ben was the chairman. I was senior co-pilot rep. We happened to be flying a Martin trip together, and we were southbound. I don't remember the trip number, but it was back in the days when Tony Harmon would let us swap seats with a captain agreeable to it after Tony had flown with us. And I was in a left seat. It was my takeoff out of Charleston, and it was one of those nights with light freezing rain sort of thing, and it was nighttime. So we headed out there and took off, and Ben turned the wing heat on, and we climbed up through this stuff, wound up on top. Ben forgot to turn the heat off, and so they were burning fuel out there, and we were on top, heading along in the moonlight south to Charlotte, drinking coffee and talking ALPA, and, you know, Captain Mitty didn't let us have autopilots or anything, so I'm kind of hand-flying it with my elbow on my knee, and all of a sudden the airplane shuddered. And Ben looked at me, and I looked at him, and, you know, we thought, well, maybe there's a little chop there. So we kept on shooting the breeze, and the next thing, it shuddered real good. And we looked down. I looked down, and we had about 90 knots blowing. The BMEPs were wandering all over the place. And Ben took out his flashlight, and he said, good heavens, Bob, take a look out there. So I looked out on the left side. Props were rubbing on ice on the cowling and the nose. The old Martin in R2800 had a scoop up on top, and it was icing over. And on my side, it was down to a hole about the size of a watermelon, or, well, no, I mean a grapefruit or so, and getting smaller. Yeah. And we began losing altitude. And back in those days, you know, we didn't talk to air traffic control. We talked to the company, told the company we were losing altitude. We were up in the mountains up there around, I think Sugarloaf used to be something like that, somewhere a reporting point up there in the mountains. But we were losing altitude, and we were in trouble. And I was down to about 85 knots and losing altitude and no power to speak of. Both engines still running, turned the alcohol on. That didn't help at all on the scoop out there. All of a sudden, Ben reached over and snatched the mixture back on the left engine. She let out a big bang, and, man, we almost cartwheeled when it came back in. And obviously able to level off and climb a little bit with the Martin. Fortunately, the wing heaters that stayed on, and we pretty much lost it except for run back. We got all the way down probably halfway from there to Charlotte before we finally got to right it. Started, and we had circle Charlotte for about an hour until we could get the ice off of the windshield so we could land. It was just one of those times we'd gotten into some tops of super cooled. Doesn't happen often. I don't think it ever happened to me again with the airline, but it was an interesting experience for Ben, God bless his soul, and myself and the old Martin. That's it.
Well, Bob, so good to hear from you tonight. What an interesting experience that was. There's so many stories.
There's a bunch of them out there. I think we all have them, and if we stop to think about them, you know, it's a lot of reminiscing there. Even if they were what they call it, minutes of stark terror and hours of boredom.
Exactly.
We all have a bunch of them, don't we?
Yeah. Now I've told everyone that you. Did buy the Stearman that John and I owned, and I guess you probably still have the old 1935 Mike certificate, don't you?
No, it's I changed it out for one of the Stearmans I got. It's but I do have the fabric rolled up, and one of these days I'll get it back to Wayne Johnson. I have it rolled up on one of the shelves here in the hangar. But
well, I'll tell you what, if Wayne doesn't want it, I would certainly love to have it. I don't know what my wife would say, but I tell you what, I'd love to have it, Bob. But
well, it's just rolled up. It's you know, that old enamel that we put hardener in when we rebuilt that thing, and I say we, actually Wayne did most of the work, and the old fella down at Newberry, South Carolina. But, those were good times. I have the aft section of the fuselage and a bunch of other stuff from that. Still got the one of the parachutes that, in fact, the one that, what was his name? Ray, no, it wasn't Ray. It was, who was your partner back then that spun into that thing?
John Cornei.
Yeah, John, yeah. I think I still have the chute, the backpack that John had, or a seat pack. I don't know. Got a couple of them sitting on top of a shelf out there also in the hangar.
Well,
but anyway, guys, it's kind of nice hearing your voices, really.
Good to hear you, Bob. And Steve McDonald, if you ever need any parts, here's Bob Vitale. You know.
Well, I was going to say the last time I talked to Bob, he wouldn't sell me any parts. That's been a long time ago, though, Bob.
Well, you shouldn't wreck your airplane.
Yeah. You know, that was August 11th of 1984. Thanks for remembering. I've had a new one since then.
At our age, you know, that already
Jim Hart?
Kind of think about.
Yes, Neil, I'm here.
Yeah.
I would like to tell a story about a non-aviation event that took place that a lot of you youngsters might not know about. I was city sales manager, Washington, D.C. This was in 63. I was there when JFK was assassinated. Well, we had a call from home office, and it said, hey, you guys, we're building a new airport out there called Dulles International Airport. We want you to get in touch with our congressmen and senators and arrange a bus tour out there, a number of bus tours, and show them exactly what Eastern Airlines is doing out there. Well, they had our ticket counter thing pretty well established, and they had just started those vehicles that took you from the main terminal out to the airplane.
People eaters.
Yeah.
That was it. But the thing that I remembered, we had about 18 sales reps in the office at that time, and I said, guys, we got to get in touch with our congressmen and senators and set up a trip out there. So we set up, I guess it was 3 or 4 bus loads and so on. And I said, listen, guys, before the bus leaves, take your guys to lunch at least to show them that Eastern Airlines wants the business from the government. Well, you know, that all happened, and after the trip, I had a meeting with all the sales reps, and I said, well, how'd everything go? Well, Smokey, who was in charge of the military movement, said everything went well, and so on and so forth. Well, anyway, it came to one of the other young men. I thought he could really handle it. I had him handle Everett Dirksen. Now, you all know Everett Dirksen was a son of a gun on expenses and frivolous type of spending. I said, well, where did you take Senator Dirksen for lunch? He said, I took him to the White Tower. And I said, well, listen, the White Tower, that's a hamburger joint. Oh, yeah, he said, that was great. And he said, you know, he said, I know this Rickenbacker, and he really tries to save on every aspect of handling the business. And he said, fine, do you know, Senator Dirksen evidently enjoyed the White Tower. That's the last I ever heard of that.
Yeah, I think fate as a hunter had something to do with the fact that we didn't get many Root Awards after that.
That was it. That was one of them.
Neil, it's Steve Thompson.
Yes, Steve.
I hope that maybe Bob Vitale is still on the line, and he certainly will remember this. The last show, someone asked who owned or operated the Delta Air Base, and my memory kicked in, and the name was Jinx Caldwell.
Well,
Bob, are you there?
Oh, yeah, I'm still here.
Yeah. Yeah, I asked that question.
Jinx is the president of the Charlotte Aircraft Corporation. They actually operated their business out there later on, but actually Ben Akin,
yeah, that's what,
and I can't remember who else. There'll be some of the Johnny Clower would probably know, or somebody like that. Ben Akin, while he was here in Charlotte before I showed up in 56, he and
was Slim somebody, part of that group, Bob?
Who is that?
Was Slim Cox part of that group? He and Ben Akin and
I don't know what was Slim. Slim wasn't. Tony Harmon was here when I came on board, but you know, Ben talked to me about it a lot. There was that fellow here that could throw his voice, you know, could go everywhere. He wasn't an Eastern pilot. He was involved. He had the Luscombe dealership out there. But Ben wasn't in it all that long, but it was at the old Delta Air Base. And there's stories about that, too, when Jinx Caldwell had the business. his son Jinx Jr. now runs the business. Jinx passed away here a few years ago, but anyway, it's bringing up a lot of old memories. I used to fly those.
Does it still exist, Bob?
Yeah.
Oh, I'll be darned.
I used to fly. I used to take a Martin after Easton sold the Martins. I used to take a Martin either out of Charlotte here or Rock Hill or Lancaster, and we had them parked all over the place and take them up to Winston solo by myself and bring a DC-3 back solo and put it in the Delta over there, which Delta was 1,300 feet long, and you know, you had tree limbs in your landing gear and everything by the time you got it on the ground. But it just is sort of sad to see them almost immediately start tearing them apart and throwing them into the smelter they had out there, and they come out as chunks of aluminum, you know. Man, we're going back a ways.
You know, Bob, you mentioned flying solo a Martin or a DC-3, but after a while, when you fly a 727 for several thousand hours, you automatically think that, hey, I could do this solo. I don't need a co-pilot or an engineer. I could do it by myself. But sometimes you have that feeling, especially the two-man crew. You know, you could fly a 757 or a 767 or a 747 very easily, I believe, solo.
Well, the FAA had to come along, you know, and change rules.
As long as nothing goes wrong.
Well, you know, on the Martin, all you had to have was a stick with two nails in the end of it to reach over there and switch it in the blower. That's about all you really needed, you know, and an arm long enough to reach the lever latch on the DC-3 so I could get the gear up and down. But anyway, that's a long time ago, and a lot of water under the dam, don't, or over the dam, don't you think?
Yeah. Well, listen, guys, we're going to just, I guess, wrap it up right now, and we've gone over our hour, but that's okay. We have had fun tonight, and I think with the interaction of those with you guys, it's really been fun for me. And, Bud?
I've enjoyed it. This was tremendous.
And this from a United captain here.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Margaret?
Well, as always, you know, I'm continuously learning about airplanes. And, again, still a white-knuckle flyer, but I've learned a lot, and I'm enjoying it.
Well, let's wrap it up by telling you folks that our travel center is now open for business, and we're taking reservations. So on the website, if you go on the website, you'll find on the homepage a little icon that says Travel Center. And by golly, if you click on that little icon, it'll take you right to our reservation center for any type of reservations you want to make, whether it's for a flight, or whether it's for a car rental, a hotel rental, if you want to take a cruise, vacation planning, and so forth. So it's all there. So make sure you check it out. And I think you'll really like that. Even if you just want to check out airline schedules, you can go right to this and find out what flights are available to the city that you want to go to. So remember to use that. And a reminder for all of you guys that might be going to the REPA convention, the Retired Eastern Pilots Association convention in October. It's October 28th, 29th, and 30th. In Tampa, Florida. Remember, if you're flying to Tampa, to make sure you go to our website and book your reservations right there. We have over 20 pages now for you to explore. We keep it updated almost daily. And so if you want to find out what the latest is, go to the newsletter page. And so we try to keep that updated daily. And by the way, we're heard in over 30 countries around the world now. Over 30 countries are tuning into our radio show. So one of these days we might get a call from someone we can't understand because we just don't recognize that language. But it's a great site. And also, while you're there on the website, make sure you check in with the web store And there, as we mentioned earlier, you can get a CD of 35 years of Reaper magazines, the Repartee magazine. And in that CD, you'll find the best of Repartee and all of that for $19.95. What a great Christmas or any type of gift that you want to give someone that has a connection with Eastern Airlines.
You know, it would be nice to talk to another foreign carrier to see if their lives are anything similar to what our lives have been.
Absolutely.
Remember to try to attend many luncheons across the country, Puerto Rico and Mexico. Get involved in good Eastern family fellowship. We will be remembered for a long time if we keep Eastern's legacy alive. Support EARA, REPA, the Silver Liners, and other organizations, websites, and shows like this radio show.
And speaking of the radio show, tell your friends about the show. Tell them to go to our website at www.ealradioshow.com. And there on the home page is the connection to the show every Monday at 7 p.m. East Coast time. They can also register as a club member and take advantage of the many interesting web pages, like the travel page Neil just mentioned, the historians page, the memorial page, the website, great Eastern video commercials, and Eastern people photo albums, and much more. And don't miss the website's newsletter of the most recent happenings.
Now, at the end of each show, we have, the last couple of shows anyhow, we have tried to include some music that some of our club members have put together, and they, by the way, are very professional. And we're trying to air some of those as our closeout music for our show. And so tonight's closeout music is was composed by Captain Bob Furman in Atlanta, Georgia, and Dale Alton, his partner. They composed a guitar song that I think you'll enjoy hearing tonight when we sign off. But that's about all we have for you tonight for our show. Make sure you tune in again next Monday at 7 p.m. with Eastern's Flight 34. That will be taxiing from the gate with an extra special interview. That's our show for tonight. We hope you've enjoyed it. So from all of us here at the Eastern Radio Show and the Eastern family, where all the women are unequaled, all the men are good-looking, and all the children and grandchildren are above average, we'll say...
Good night, Margaret, Bud, and Steve.
Good night, Jim, Bud, Neil, Steve Thompson, Steve McDonald.
Ditto. Good night, Jim, Margaret, Neil, and Steve.
Good night, Bud, Jim, Margaret, Steve, Luann, and Steve, and Luann, wherever you are.
And this is Luann, senior flight attendant from Air Kentucky, just taking a moment to say good night, y'all. You did a great show, and make sure you always fly right side up.
Good night, Eastern
family. Good night,
family.
Eastern, good night family. Eastern family.
Good night, everyone, from Martha's Vineyard.
Told you, baby. Heaven says so.